Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight,
Mark, Callahan 4, continuing in our Harry Callahan marathon from 1983. The whole Carter administration happened a couple years into Reagan. You and I were both born. All the Star Wars movies were made in that window. So I'd say three significant things happened. Me being born, the Star Wars movies, and the Reagan beginning of the Reagan administration. You just saw this recently.
The space shuttle.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. So give us a little take. Where does this 1983 find Inspector Harry Callahan? A little grizzled. It's 12 years since the first one. So what does that put him at? That puts him at 20 years.
20 years.
On the job? Because in Magnum Force, they mentioned that that him and his friend had both been on for about 10. And that was 2 years after the first. So you deduct that, and you got to say that probably about 20 years.
Well, I was going to say he was 53. He was born 1930.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say he's getting close to retirement age.
Definitely. Feeling aware. Captain is back. The asshole captain from The Enforcer is back.
Captain Briggs.
And,
who's a legend, apparently.
Legend in his own mind. And so the first one starts out, there's a lot of different irons in the fire here. Some woman that just kills this guy mysteriously out at Makeout Point.
And then, who just mysteriously happens to be played by Clint Eastwood's wife at the time.
Yeah. And then we got Callahan going in and mixing it up at a mafioso's granddaughter's wedding.
Yeah, was it... I was trying to remember the name of the character from The Godfather Part 2. I remember he ends up going to prison.
I don't know. I don't remember.
That got sort of insulted.
Yeah, he was the guy that he killed himself, right? He's the one that slit his wrists in the bathtub.
He did?
I think so in Godfather 2. I think it's that guy.
I thought he...
Yeah, he does go to jail, and he's in jail for a while, and then Tom comes and sees him and basically lets him know, hey, you know, kill yourself, because this is the only way you can really make things right at this point or something. It was all very Japanese. And then you've got these punks that just got let off because the gun that was used as evidence against them was procured through improper search and seizure. Callahan's just not following the rules. He's just not keeping up with it. Yeah, so, 1983. He's looking worn and... So, pretty much from the get-go, we've got mafioso guys chasing after him because they blame him for giving their boss a heart attack. And then we've got these punks chasing after him with Molotov cocktails. So, basically, all that happens, and they're like, okay, look, we've been telling you to go on vacation and get out of town, you know, just go somewhere, cool off. Here, I got an excuse. I'll keep you on the job, but you go investigate this guy that was shot, this guy that was killed by, you know... Left with his balls shot off in a car. Apparently he was from San Paolo or whatever. Some made-up town that's supposed to be...
Either north or south of San Francisco.
It's either north or south of San Francisco, depending on who you ask. And it's sort of a combination between Santa Cruz and Carmel or Petaluma or something almost. It looks like sort of a tourist trap kind of town by the ocean, which Petaluma isn't. Maybe it is. Gosh. No, anyway, I don't know.
Next to the ocean.
Well, I just remember that there's a section where there's boats. Maybe there's a lake or something.
Well, there are lakes there. It's not... Petaluma's too far north to be at the end of, like, North Bay.
Yeah. It's not part of the bay, that's for sure. Anyway. So then it turns into kind of a Callahan on vacation thing. And he basically goes...
Well, you forgot about Horace.
Yeah, well, there's Horace. Horace is his partner, and Horace is played by the same guy that sort of made a different role in every movie so far.
Right.
He was the bank robber.
Bank robber that wants to know, gots to know.
He's the bank robber. He's the pimp.
He's
with the Drano.
That knows about the SNAS bank.
The SNAS bank, yes.
And
then he's the militant.
Yeah, he is Big Ed Mustafa.
Yes.
And now he's Horace.
Horace's partner, who helps him out a little bit, and then kind of isn't really his
partner. Dog.
His partner's really not that relevant in this. This Callahan movie is much different than the other ones because, like I said, they take
Because there's a female lead.
They take him out of the mix of being in San Francisco. He's not pounding the pavement in San Francisco. He does a little bit at the beginning, but almost not really at all.
Well, you forgot about the signature scene.
Oh,
well, fact,
yeah.
Where he goes into the diner.
The scene at the diner.
With the coffee.
With the coffee and the shooting.
The 10 years of coffee.
Uh-huh.
It was black.
Always black, and she put sugar. She put a lot of sugar in it.
A lot of sugar. He was going to complain.
He was going to complain.
And he wasn't going to let him walk out of there.
No.
Or we weren't.
No, him and Smith and Wesson.
Yep. And that was awesome, but I need a poster of that. The poster.
Yeah, it's a good shot.
Yeah, it's perfect.
We should mention that now. This is the this film, Sudden Impact, fourth in the Callahan series,
yep,
is both produced and directed by Clint Eastwood himself. And so I was looking with my keen eye to sort of see differences between... Because the first three films, had each one had a different director, but aesthetically they kind of followed the same... They looked similar. And this one immediately is different because it's got these cityscape... it's got these cityscape shots of San Francisco at night... And helicopter stuff, and then it kind of does some pull in, and then there's a dolly shot, and the first few minutes of it read almost like a very kind of creepy suspense movie, and in a weird way, the whole thing to me feels kind of like an Alfred Hitchcock kind of film. It's got like this psychological thriller aspect to it that's different than all of the other films. It sort of works, but it definitely makes it its own thing a little more than the other ones, which I think is sort of a detriment, because I wanted to see Callahan pounding the pavement in inexplicably sunny San Francisco, like we have in the first three movies. But this is like the, you know, fish out of water kind of
thing. I think he should have taken over for Andy Griffith, kind of like Charles Bronson did.
Yes, he should have. I shot
him. That would have been great.
So. But, like I said, there's like a lot going on, and certain things just don't get resolved. Like, the whole mafioso element ends up kind of like...
Well,
people chase after
him. Finally, or like, how many of our,
yeah,
you know,
guys
thugs do we want to go through?
Sending after him, yeah. It's just... And then the Molotov cocktail guys kind of, I guess, they get dealt with. He kind of throws it back on them, and then their car goes in the drink, and then I guess we assume...
None of them come up.
Well, they probably just got arrested. They probably swam out, and he probably just, you know, held them
there. Trapped in the car.
Maybe that was it. So then the story does turn into this sort of exploration of this psychological thriller about this woman that killed this guy, and like, why did she do this? And you pretty quickly learn that she's on a revenge spree because she's damaged because her sister is now catatonic and
because of the dike.
Because they were both taken. Down,
the
pretense of some party down under the boardwalk where a bunch of biker creeps
and not really
bikers, but I guess just the creepy local
the queer
scumbags.
And the dyke and Mr. Prosperous and
Mr.
Kruger.
And Cougar and our buddy Mick.
And yeah, Mick is awesome. I don't think I ever got as much satisfaction out of any of the bad guys getting blown away as I did Mick. Because Mick just... God.
I guess, but I still have to go with the first guy from
the first one. The first
because that one. Guy that guy was creepy, but he was also, like... He had the whole money angle, and he had the whole, like, embarrassment angle. Mick was just a fucking nutcase. And kind of a scuzzy dumbass. This other guy was much more twisted.
True. He was more twisted, but... At the same time, it's not like he was...
Yeah. Well, Mick goes good. I mean, Eastwood, in his directorial subtlety, lets us know just what's going to be the final instrument of Mick's death for a good solid, like, 10 to 15 seconds.
I'm thinking that he was probably dead already.
Yeah, I know. I know, hit, but the final,
having been hit four times,
the final
with a 44 auto mag,
the final horn in the coffin, you know,
300 grain bullets.
Yeah,
this shit. One of those will blow your fucking arm off.
Probably. Oh, they should have had that happen instead. That would have been awesome.
That would have been awesome, like a RoboCop kind of scene.
Oh yeah, I know. And speaking of which, now we're well into the '80s and 83. This film is much more. In a weird way, it's almost more gruesome than the other ones. I mean, I know in the first one you've got, like, naked, you know, drowned girl and stuff, but it's all done, like, in a very, like, realistic, clinical kind of sense. And this is, it's sort of like a glorified, but also really twisted, it's 80s violence, you know what I mean?
That's why it was appreciated, the first one, the most, because the first one was by far, had the least amount of camp.
Yeah.
2 through 5, they have some fun.
Yeah, they do, but I mean, it's still never fun. Like, I mean, I know what you mean about camp, and I mean, you can look
like,
at some of it,
like,
and you can go
Hansen. I never thought of it as a game.
Yeah, that. I mean, you know, he's got his clever lines and everything, and that's still there. And Callahan's pretty consistent in this film, even though you are putting him in a different environment, so you're kind of forcing him to act differently.
Well,
like,
you know,
he sits down and has a beer with a girl in this, and it's sort of weird.
He did with the Asian chick, too. And
yeah,
he tried
true.
To
he
with the Tyne Daly, but all they had
was
apple
juice. That's true.
He's a beer.
But they were different contexts. I don't know.
He was drinking Oli.
Yeah.
In
but just like in this one, it's like because he's on vacation, it's just sort of very strange. He's not like in his own jurisdiction. He's not like seeing.
He's under Pat Hingle's.
Yeah, he's under Pat Hingle's thumb, and he's got the bulldog. Which I don't know what the deal was. That just for comic relief?
Yes.
Because the bulldog was just kind of stupid, and maybe it was a throwback to the Any Which Way kind of movies. You know, it was like just another joke animal to put with Clint Eastwood for a little bit.
I think that's probably true. It also served as a. Sort of a touching moment at the end, also.
You mean when it was all hobbled?
When they hobbled his dog.
Yeah, I guess. But, I mean, killing his partner, I think, trumps hobbling the dog.
People sometimes have a harder time. It's like if somebody in a movie walks up, or even in real life, walks up and kicks a guy when he's down.
Yeah.
It has less impact than if somebody walks up to, like, a crippled dog and kicks it.
Or Benji's girlfriend gets kicked by the burglars and Benji too.
Yes.
And in a house, and then she's like, "Whoa!"
Yes.
And loses the babies. Loses the whole litter.
The whole litter.
Yeah.
Well, there's more of those kings.
There's no littering. This was the 80s, and littering was not a good idea back then.
Oh, the Indian in the canoe?
Uh-huh.
I think that was the 70s.
Well, who knows?
There was
it got,
Al.
Yeah.
Give a hoot and don't
give
play.
A hoot.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. This one, it's like Eastwood's definitely putting his mark on this film. And, like I said, it felt almost like a psychological thriller, Hitchcock kind of movie in places. It's still got the great ending chase in a unique environment. So far they've managed to do a different one for every movie. And in this one it's like this carousel thing. But I think what I'm missing San Francisco in this movie. And it's such a vital part of the first three in terms of like it's like a character, you know, and it sounds hokey. And
there's a great chase scene in 5 too.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, but
there's a couple of them, actually.
I would imagine so. But I'm just kind of like...
Yeah, foot and car.
Yeah. I think this one just is not... It's not working for me the way I wanted it to. I mean, I want my Callahan... One thing. Other than him and then that the return of the asshole captain, who... Briggs? That was his name?
Briggs.
Yeah. There's no one else. It's just those two. And in the first, like, three, you had DiGiorgio, and you had,
DiGiorgio,
and you had, the same lieutenant, I think.
Yeah, Harry Gardner.
You had, like, a couple more people, so it was, I don't know, you felt more connected. And in this, it's really kind of, like, lonely. It's like it's just him. And everything's gone past. I mean, maybe that's the point they're kind of trying to make. But they can't do it if they don't keep him in the same environment. By moving him on, putting him on vacation and moving him to a different place. And then, like you said, making this the Sandra Locke character like you said, almost like an official sort of secondary character or lead character, it really kind of changes the feeling of the movie, and really for the first time, you end up empathizing with who's ostensibly the criminal, or at least the main antagonist of the film for the most part, because she's the one that's creating the leading the investigation.
Kind of like Bela Lugosi Wales, you sympathize with the man whose family was brutalized and murdered.
Well, yeah, of course.
Because he's going out to get justice.
Well, yeah, I know. It's a revenge picture, but it's weird to see that in the context of Callahan, because, I mean, what you're really doing in this film is you're kind of retroactively, well, not retroactively, but you're kind of dealing with the vigilante kind of issue.
Like Magnum Force.
Like in Magnum Force, but there's now it's a different context. Yeah, exactly.
The huge difference is in Magnum Force, none of the killers had been hurt directly from the people they were killing.
Yeah, that's true. They were all sort of avenging for the society or something, and that was their, I mean, was their thing. But the point is, I mean, I didn't have a problem with the ending. I agreed with the ending. But it was a little too neat. And it, in a weird way,
After watching movies like Broken Flowers, I can deal with neat.
Oh, I'm sure. But it's like, I'm used to those Callahan movies where it's just, it's not like a settled ending. And in this, it's kind of, it's very strange. It's almost like...
Well, I think they probably didn't intend on making a five.
Well, even if they didn't intend on making a five, it's just a weird way to end this film. I honestly thought she would die.
You know what's kind of funny is really the traditional ending they did in the middle of the movie.
I know they did. In a weird way, they kind of did. But it didn't have that, sort of conclusion that it usually has, because it was the middle, and so it was like, it wasn't like he'd taken care of the
mafia. Usually there are questions at the end of the movie.
Yeah, a little bit, but
a little bit.
I don't know, all I'm saying is that the way this one ends is different, and I mean, I guess I expected it to have a different conclusion with the antagonist, with the Sandra Locke character. I expected things to go differently for her. I didn't expect her to kind of make it out, as it were.
You wanted Mick to have his party, is that what you're saying?
No, but I didn't expect her to live. I expected it to be one of those, you know, she catches the stray bullet from Mick kind of thing at the last second, then Callahan shoots. And then it gives Callahan his nihilistic ending alone, and she's kind of like been vindicated by him maybe at the moment of her death. Like, you know, like, I understand that you did this, but, you know. And then he could still pin it on the other guy. But it's not like she's left alive and he's got his arm around her at the end, like it is now. That kind of ending just feels... It doesn't feel right for a Callahan movie. And I almost wonder if this story, as sort of a psychological thriller or revenge thing, sort of started before it was generated into a Callahan film. You know what I mean? Like if maybe it wasn't originally supposed to be Dirty Harry property, and then it kind of became that. You know what I mean? It just feels the most different out of the three. It feels like the idea of making it Callahan was after the fact of the idea of making this revenge story.
It's possible.
So,
obviously, Clint Eastwood wasn't interested in doing another Dirty Harry movie for quite a while.
Well, who knows? I mean, there could have just not been a proper script for it, or he was doing, I mean, a lot of other stuff in that period, of course.
What, there was 7 years? 7 years is a long time.
And, you know, everything has changed. The, like, a lot. Like, between 76 and 83, a lot of things. I mean, pretty much all of disco happened between 76 and 83.
That's true.
And, fashion started to change, and...
Cocaine
came into the mix. And, I mean, 83 is like almost the beginning of hair metal. I mean, it's a lot of
punk,
things.
New wave.
Punk and new wave and all that stuff. And you can hear it in the soundtrack. Like you said, it's got a little bit of an 80s, like, synth beat techno kind of bit to it, which is completely inauthentic as a Dirty Harry movie. It's like it's like that one aspect of it, it's trying to evolve, but the rest tries to stick to Callahan, except
wait
it puts it in
a
new environment. Yeah, I know. I'll get to it when I get to it. So, I don't know. I mean, I think as a story, it's an interesting story. It's a revenge story. I mean, you know, It's nothing new. Maybe for the time it was a little more new. And it certainly got sort of a grabbing aspect to it there. But Callahan just doesn't work for me unless he's in San Francisco. Because he needs to be in that, like, city.
So the movie worked for you for, like, 40, 50 minutes?
It was, but it was very... It was scattered, because that was when there was the three different storylines going. There was the Mafia guys chasing after him.
He wrapped that up pretty much.
There was... Yeah, but they didn't even get wrapped up till after the Bulldog saved his ass on the last guy back up when he...
That's true. That was the driver he followed. Yeah. That was the last dude.
Uh-huh. I guess, presumably. And then there were the Molotov cocktail kids.
That got wrapped up. Because, you know, the car hit the...
Yeah, I know.
Hit the water, knocked them all out, and they drowned.
I'm just saying that, like, yeah, for the first 45 minutes, I was like, where is this going to go? And I guess I just was less interested in that revenge story of the woman. I honestly, at the beginning, when he goes into the wedding, and it's like, oh, wow, they're going to have him, like, actually take on some organized crime stuff. This could be a real interesting, like, Callahan versus organized crime kind of story. You know, something really raised the stakes. And so they kind of like, started that and then kind of just sort of let it sort of dissipate.
There's some of that in Five.
It was kind of a blind alley, I guess. And that was disappointing to me. I guess it felt like an 80s cop TV show, this one, a little bit.
80s cop TV
show. It felt like an episode of Hunter or something, because it's like he's walking around in his jacket, and he's just kind of like, you know, he's having a beer at, like, dating the girl.
Jogging.
Out at the thing, he's jogging, and...
Which was 80s.
Yeah, and it all was, like, shot, like, not in a city, but rather, like it...
Pat Hingle.
In houses, and you know, by the ocean and stuff. It didn't, it wasn't really very gritty. It looked like, basically, even the scumbags looked like they had nice, like, sort of vacation homes, you know? Like, they all were living in Trinidad or something. It was weird.
Yeah, well,
not Trinidad. North
Carolina. Surprised me a little.
California.
Bit.
It's a quaint little Northern California burg. So, yeah, closing on Callahan.
Can we say Callahan for governor?
Oh, fuck yeah. Callahan and his 80-year-oldness.
I think he was like a mayor.
He was mayor of Carmel.
Yeah, right.
And which is where we think maybe they did shoot this. And so
I'm gonna look it up.
Yeah, Eastwood put his own kind of mark on it, and in some aspects,
I don't think he directed Five.
In some aspects, it's elevated from its style, because I mean, there's a few.
It definitely is a different style.
Interesting dolly shots, and like you said, that part where he takes down the guys in the coffee shop, that looks real good. There's some really great, like, camera work there, where see the tip of the gun.
And it's like, with the, I'd say that's the most, it's a toss-up. It's a toss-up between that and Do You Feel Lucky, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, and Reagan, you know, Go Ahead, Make My Day. It's very famous.
Mm-hmm. Can't go wrong.
But, no, you can't. That's great. Yeah, it's, like I said, I want a big, like, freaking 24x18 poster of that.
Yeah, a little panoramic style. Makes sense. But, yeah, you know, it just... I'm sorry, but I'm just... There's a little bit of disappointment for me in this one. I liked what I liked about it, but it puts... I have to give it a 3. It isn't in the range of 1 and 2. I gave 3... a 3.5, and I gave 1 and 2 both a 4, and so this one I've got to give a 3. It's just not working for me the way I want it to. It's not giving me what I want. And as a film, it still sort of works, but I don't know. I want Callahan in San Francisco busting perps, making one-liners. I want him and his partner actually doing police work, which they hardly did together at all. I don't think they did any of that in this. Him and his partner kind of meet socially, and then later he calls him, and then his partner shows up just in time to get killed, which is lame. There was almost no actual, like, good old-fashioned police, like, cop work done in this movie at all. He kind of just stumbled. These murders happened so quickly once he got to the burg, he kind of stumbled across. And like I said, in a weird way, it felt like a psychological suspense horror movie. Maybe because of the setting. You know, I kept expecting John Carpenter's The Fog to roll in and Adrian Barbeau to be screaming and yelling on the radio.
You saw The Fog?
I've seen parts of it, yeah.
And again, another tie-in.
Because Adrienne Barbeau was John Carpenter's wife. Yeah, I know.
No, no.
And Sandra Locke was Clint Eastwood's wife. These directors love to put their wives in their movies. Yes. It all connects. Now, I gotta give it a 3. It's just not...
I'm giving it a 4, just for the automag all by itself.
There was some cool stuff
in it. I'd give it a 4 just for the one, my favorite scene, which is, in my opinion, the most iconic scene of Clint Eastwood. Well, no, not Clint Eastwood, but Harry Callahan.
You're talking about the coffee shop?
Coffee shop.
Coffee shop is good. It's a couple good parts. It's just, damn it, I want to see him being a cop. And I don't feel like you got to see him being a cop because he was on vacation.
See him riding roughshod on Liam Neeson in the next one, so...
Hey, we'll see. Hopefully it'll be good. I don't know. We'll see.
And he gets an Asian partner.
About time.
Because it's good for the department's image.
Of course it is. Ah, yes. Well, if you guys want to talk to us through the Futile Podcast, you can send us an email, futilepodcast@gmail.com.
We never talked about, we were supposed to, and we never talked about...
I'm going to kill it if we're going to talk about some other movie. And then
no, you said recording. That we were going to.
Going down to Emmett's Fix-It Shop to fix Emmett. Oh gosh, what are you doing? Oh no!